Sean Carroll needs no introduction. He's been introduced many times already in this conference. Nonetheless, I'll introduce him. That's Sean Carroll back there. And the panel is the intertextual Einstein.
Thank you. I thought we're going to be talking about intertextual Einstein. So you're supposed to imagine the figure of Einstein surrounded by all sorts of books and things like that. As far as I can tell, I'm not quite sure what it means. But I thought, I don't know if this is going to work, because my computer seems to be acting up. I thought we could start with the textual Einstein.
Followed from the special theory of relativity, that mass and energy are food, are different manifestations of the same thing. A somewhat unfamiliar conception for the average mind. Furthermore, the equation E is equal mc squared, in which energy is put equal to mass multiplied with the square of the velocity of light, showed that very small amount of mass may be converted into a very large amount of energy, and vice versa. The mass and energy were in fact equivalent, according to the formula mentioned above. This was demonstrated by Kokler and Walton in 1932, experiment.
So that was, he couldn't be here for the conference, but that actually was Albert Einstein. This is on the web, yes, and he must have been after 1932, but otherwise I don't know. The picture need not be associated with the actual recording, so I don't know. You could tell he just didn't like speaking English very much, but it's fascinating just to hear his own voice. And we have a wonderful panel for you here today. I'm going to introduce them from this side to that side, and they're going to speak in a different order. Paul Harris, immediately to my left, is professor of English and Marymount Institute Chair of Interdisciplinary Studies at Loyola Marymount. And he's a scholar whose interests are interdisciplinary but focusing on the issue of time, and is in fact the president of the International Society for the Study of Time, which I did not know existed before today, but it sounds like something worth joining. To his left is Ralph Remshart, associate professor at the School of Theater and Dance at the University of Florida. He is a director of plays, a translator of plays from German, and teaches theater history and playwriting. And his most recent book is Staging the Savage God, the Grotesque in Performance. And to Ralph's left is, as you know, Kate McConnell, who's a graduate student at Yale in the MFA program, I believe, and who's studying the relationship of science and drama, as we all are hearing about today. And to her left is Dennis Overby, who is the author of what I still think is my favorite cosmology book of all time, Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos. And I would never make fun of that title. It's a brilliant title. And so none of us know what it means to talk about intertextual Einstein, but we're going to try to make it up as we go along. Einstein is obviously an important figure, the person of the century, according to Time magazine, and it's one of those rare cases where he lives up to the hype. So understanding both what he said and what role he represented is important. So I think we're going to start with Dennis.
Yeah, yesterday somebody was, and I don't remember who, was talking about plays and Einstein lying on a beach and different positions asking, when do we know it's not Einstein? And which made me immediately write in my notebook, when do we know it is Einstein? And so, my main contribution to this is just going to be a question. But so there's a story that we all know and love, which Einstein is playing music with some friends, and they start playing, but it's not right, the conductor stops. They start again. It's not right. They stop again. They start playing again. It still doesn't work. Finally, the conductor turns around and scowls and says, Einstein, can't you count? So everybody loves this story. And in fact, in the Einstein world, every other person you meet will claim that he knows somebody or had a great grandfather who was there, which means it either happened a lot or Einstein played before very large gatherings. But what's interesting to me is that, in fact, Einstein could count. I mean, I don't know if he could count musically. People who've played with him said he was good for an amateur. But in every other way, history, a detailed look at his life shows he could count. I mean, he took finance courses in college, and if you read his letters to Maleva during their divorce, he's like, he's shrewdly pushing their money around here and there, trying to escape the German inflation. And at one point, he talks about putting the money in Brazil. He's like a very witty, intuitive guy whose friends are scared to death of his sarcasm. He's good at getting women to fall in love with him. He adroitly climbs the ladder, the academic ladder, from various institutions, from Zurich to Prague to Zurich to Berlin to Princeton. Have I left anything out here? So he's really a very, my favorite part. I mean, he's politically very involved. We see him in old age spending 2 hours every day reading the New York Times, and now I have to quote from a poem that he wrote to a friend about this: only the Times with its hypocrisies makes men stupider than they really are. And making very hard-headed decisions about what political causes and events and people to put his name on and what not to, sometimes angering those people. I mean, the private Einstein was somewhat more cynical than the public Einstein, the cuddly guy that we know. So the point is, Einstein some clearly conspired in the creation of his own image. And I want to read one letter that he wrote. I think you see this beginning in World War I in Germany. Like, at one point, he writes to his friend Zonker in Zurich that he just heard that the population of Europe had grown to some number, I don't remember what it is, hundred or 200 million or something like that. And he says, a horrible number, which almost makes you want to root for the war, which he says is a horrible thought. But anyway, at another time, he lets his hair down to his friend Zonker. This is 1915, and his friend Zonker is depressed about the war, and he keeps trying to cheer up his friend Zonker. In this time, one sees that the only thing really worth pursuing in the world is the friendship of superb and free people who can't be led to the most perverse mental attitudes by any printed bullshit they read. People are not as consequent in anything, including hate and unfriendliness, as they seem. A little impartiality regarding others might help you get over it with ease. I always fare the best with my innocuousness, which is up to 20% conscious. This is easily attained when you're indifferent to the feelings of your dear fellow humans, but you are never as indifferent to them as they deserve. And he goes on to say about how he's living in this little island of calm in Berlin. You know, he's involved with his cousin Elsa, who had actually sort of induced him to move there. So my question is, why? In the last 20 years, there's been a lot of sort of unveiling of Einstein, but he's still the cuddly doll that we had pictures of in the newspaper the other day, and so I'm just wondering why. I sort of understand why Einstein would do this, because if he thinks the authorities think that he's just a holy fool, they'll kind of give him a pass. It kind of keeps people away. He can do his own thing. But what do we get out of having our geniuses be children? And I don't know the answer, and that's, I'm sort of hoping that everybody will tell me. That's it.
Thanks, Dan. Yeah, I guess I'm on this panel partly because I was one of the first people, I guess one of the first, maybe the first, to try to adapt Adam Lightman's wonderful book, Einstein's Dreams, to the stage. And one of the many problems that confronted us when we were doing that was what to do with Einstein, obviously, who is sort of part of the book. And I'm not going to tell you in detail, but the solution, in fact, worked out to be that the virtue of the book is that we're inside Einstein's head, not that Einstein is a character in the book particularly. Of course, he is to some degree. But we sort of erased Einstein more or less in our production because we felt it wasn't all that important. But it sort of led me to another question, which is, what do you do with Einstein as a character? Because it seems to me that Einstein as a character has a number of sort of built-in problems that other characters perhaps don't have. The cuddly icon is one of those problems. And so I made a little bit of a study, sort of unsystematic. I'll try to lead you through a little bit of that. The big question is really, why is there no great Einstein play yet? Because it seems to me that if there were, it would have an enormous amount of explanatory power about the 20th century somehow, or evidentiary power. But nobody seems to have really written that particular play. So one of the things seems to me that he's very hard to access because he's not simply iconic as a character. He is almost what you might call a meme in the sense that I think Richard Dawkins introduced it into the discourse, which is to say an idea that is so persuasive that it becomes kind of self-replicating. In fact, Einstein has become our meme of not really the scientist or the physicist, but of genius, which is something very different. And so it's kind of replicated itself, and that's why he ends up on the cover of Time magazine at the end of the century, right there. And he has this great sort of recognizability. There was an experiment that a teacher once did, asking school children to draw the picture of a scientist without specifying male or female, and pretty much statistically all of them basically drew somebody with fuzzy hair. So Einstein has sort of become that icon, even in school children's ideas. And in fact, of course, received an enormous amount of publicity after the special relativity, there was an empirical proof of the special relativity, parts of the special relativity was finally achieved, and he did his U.S. tour in which he became almost kind of a rock star type celebrity. So everybody knew what Einstein looked like, and everybody knew to some degree what he sounded like this. Here in his sort of charming Swabian dialect. William Carlos Williams wrote a poem called St. Francis Einstein of the Daffodils in 1921. There's a poem about Einstein by Archibald MacLeish and so forth and so forth. So all of these things make it very difficult to represent Einstein on stage because we have very, very clear ideas about what he should look like, what he should sound like, how he should behave, and so forth. Add to that the problem that I think is unique to Einstein, which is that, and he recognized this himself, in fact, felt that this was the basis of, partly the basis of his fame, that there was almost a fetishization of the incomprehensibility of his work. That in fact, denoted genius for most people, that you couldn't understand it. That was the whole point of it. So that makes it, you know, very difficult for a representational medium like theater to have access to him. The physicist Ernst Fischer is a German physicist, wrote a little book about Einstein, which he said there seemed to be four requirements, four criteria to make somebody kind of a scientific superstar. The first one is that you deal with big questions. Very, very big questions, the metaphysical ones, or the potentially metaphysical ones. The second criterion is that the theology that emerges from that is in some sense naive, which I think I might argue with, whether that's true, that criterion, but that's what he says. Third, the external appearance has to be unique and aid recognition, and there's certainly true for Einstein. And then the fourth is that you have the willingness to be a public figure and play the clown, as he says. That's certainly true for a number of famous scientists. I think Newton would fulfill some of these requirements, maybe not the clown. Recognizability, maybe perhaps more. Darwin, certainly Einstein, Feynman, Stephen Hawking, and so forth. It's certainly not true for the two most viable dramatic characters we've been talking about much at this conference, which is Heisenberg and Bohr, who are in fact quite the opposite of that. And in some ways, because we have no preconceptions of them, I think are much easier to dramatize for us. So it seems to me that the problem for the construction of a dramatic character of Einstein would be that you need almost the opposite of exactly these criteria that that Ernst Fischer had established. You need a field of action that is representable on the human scale. You need comprehensibility of motive. You need you can't have something that's totally in conflict with public perception and so forth and so forth. Then in Aristotelian terms, you've got a problem because Einstein is, for instance, has no antagonist who's sort of built in. Bit of a problem. You have, I was going to go into something about objective correlative, but I think I'll skip that. That might be too complicated. But anyway, so I looked at some plays that actually feature Einstein, or some dramas, to sort of look at what happened. And one of the things that seems to obtain in most of these is that there is some kind of an attempt at displacement of the figure of Einstein in some way, because you can't quite get to him directly. And in fact, also an attempt then to claim Einstein for a particular set of ideas or ideology that goes hand in hand with that. The first that I want to just briefly touch on is Brecht's Einstein play. Now you say, wait a minute, Brecht wrote a Galileo play, he didn't write an Einstein play. And so if you get nothing out of this talk, at least you get this bit of information, which is that when Brecht was conceiving his Galileo play, which clearly is in response to many of the developments of this science in the 1930s, and then was revised twice to take into account, of course, the dropping of the atomic bomb, a famous speech that he adds at the end of the play, that at this very same time which he was doing that, he was actually writing notes for A Life of Einstein. We have those notes. They're sort of fragmentary, but he was interested, in fact, in writing that play, and it seems like he was unsuccessful in doing it and sort of had to, in some ways, write the Galileo play because the Einstein play didn't come together. So what he did was what Brecht typically did, to historicize a particular set of problems and put them into a different kind of historical context. But what's interesting about that is that Brecht's relationship to Einstein changed frequently. In fact, had seen him lecture in the early 1920s in Berlin. They, of course, lived in Berlin at some point together. And he himself, in fact, was so enthralled with Einstein's ideas that one of his writings about experimental theater is strongly influenced by Einstein. He himself called himself the theatrical Einstein with his characteristic modesty. But he couldn't quite figure out. In fact, he sort of took an animus against Einstein and wanted to create a play in which Einstein became an almost villainous character, going beyond the tragic contradiction that seems to be inherent in Einstein, the recognition that one has contributed to the terrible weapon and so forth, to in fact establish that Einstein was the person who had aided, in fact, the rise of what Brecht at that point saw as an evil political entity, which was the United States post-war during the communist scare. And then he softened his ideas again and started, in fact, to get around to drafting the play in 1955 and died. So that's why the play doesn't exist. But it's an interesting, kind of intriguing idea that he might have written that play and what might have come of it. I have something else to say about that. Conceived it, this is the kind of interesting thing, as a choral work in which there would have been a chorus of workers. commenting on the action, very much like in the style of the sort of teaching plays of the 1930s that he wrote as well. And then later on he talked with Paul Dessau about an Einstein opera, but didn't turn into a collaboration. Paul Dessau actually did write that Einstein opera in 1973, which I haven't heard, so I don't know what it's like. But it's interesting that during the Cold War, Einstein could only be conceived, obviously, in the context of these shifting politics. And another play that takes that up very clearly is Dürrenmatt's The Physicist, in which there is another kind of displacement, which you might call a histrionic displacement, because Einstein doesn't actually appear in the play. What appears in the play are is a character who pretends to be insane and think that he is Einstein, turns out, in fact, to be quite sane, and is ironically, in the case of Dürrenmatt, a representative of what seems to be a communist power, East Germany or something like that, who is trying to spy on another physicist who is in fact the kind of displaced Einstein in the play, whose name is Möbius, and who everybody says is the greatest physicist in the world. The play begins with Einstein killing a nurse in the insane asylum, and that already that kind of provocation, as it were, I think is kind of an interesting thing to observe in Dürrenmatt's text. Dürrenmatt's conclusion, of course, is a fairly bleak one, which is that what Einstein is associated with, which is the rethinking of the conditions of the material world in many ways, that then lead to the consequences of the atomic bomb and so forth, is knowledge that is not revisable, is not you cannot take it back. In fact, the characters in that play attempt to do so, to sequester themselves, as it were, from the real world, and take back the knowledge that has been put into the world, but that is it's seen as an impossibility, and that's really, it's kind of at the height of the Cold War that this very bleak kind of conclusion is attached and connected to the name of Einstein in Dürrenmatt's play. And very briefly, a couple of other pieces. There's a piece called Insignificance by Terry Johnson, which is written in 1982, also made into a film in 1985 that some people may have seen at some point or another, in which Einstein is... in fact, he's called the professor, and there's a character called the actress, and a character called the senator, and a character called the ball player. These are, in fact, Einstein, Marilyn Monroe, and Joseph McCarthy, and Joe DiMaggio. And the play centers on a meeting, obviously entirely fictitious, meeting between Marilyn Monroe and Einstein. She comes to his hotel room to visit him there, and explores, to some degree, of course, the problems of celebrity, the sort of the mind-body problem, if you will, because in fact there's a great deal of sort of sexual tension between the two. That's at least indicated. And the great scene in that particular play is the scene in which Marilyn Monroe explains relativity to Albert Einstein. Which is a priceless scene, which makes it worth seeing a fairly inchoate movie or play, which really doesn't quite make a lot of sense. But anyway, so and this is kind of on the very cusp of the end of the Cold War, mid 1980s, in which Einstein has sort of regained this kind of iconicity, and the author plays kind of with those notions, but still kind of embeds him in the problems of the political problems. In fact, this takes place in 1953 in McCarthy and so forth, and Einstein is wearing a watch, which people ask him what the time is, and he says 8:15. It's a watch that has stopped. And nobody explains why it's 8:15 until you realize that 8:15 is the very moment at which the atomic bomb in Hiroshima exploded. So so he's kind of implicated in that way, in that text. The final one, it's been mentioned at some point, and has elicited groans, which is Picasso at the La Panagia by Steve Martin, a play, of course, in which Einstein is fairly prominent. And I have to salvage the reputation a little bit of that play. I directed it, and theatrically, of course, it works wonderfully well. But what it does in all of its kind of sort of dataist play with probability and with chronology and so forth, is that it goes back to something that I think is what Einstein now has become for us again, in some ways, what Alan Lightman's book does, which is to rediscover the young Einstein, who is in fact on the cusp of that moment of discovery, and to investigate the power of that particular moment of discovery, in particular, of course, in the way in which that play sort of collides fictitiously with Picasso's ideas. So I think that we've sort of worked our way back to being interested in that moment of discovery again, and so it seems to be an interesting kind of moment to look at Einstein again as a potential character for a play. So that I'll stop there.
Well, starting back at that moment of discovery again, I kind of take a different track around things. My interest in the intersection of science and drama is actually in plays that aren't about science. I kind of like looking at the plays where I know that the authors have been interested in science, and looking at what kind of structures you find in their plays intentionally or not. So as we heard from Alan Brody, starting around the turn of the century, drama started changing a lot. Art started changing a lot. Isms abound. There was symbolism and expressionism and cubism and futurism and cubo-futurism and constructivism, and the list goes on and on. Lots of short-lived, crazy, crazy things. And in theater, structure was changing. Content was changing, and the approach towards theater was changing. And I wanted to kind of take a look at three different playwrights who I know were interested in science and who kind of all took different tacks towards science in their work. And starting with Pirandello, who we've heard mentioned before, his Six Characters in Search of an Author is his most well-known play, which plays a lot with frames of references and what it means to be real, basically. There's a nifty piece of Apocrypha, which has Einstein, after seeing Six Characters in Search of an Author, going backstage and saying to Pirandello, "We are soulmates." And I think he might have liked it even more had he gone to see a lesser-known play by Pirandello called Right You Are If You Say You Are, which was written in 1917. And it basically concerns this one mysterious figure of a woman who, basically, her husband and her mother-in-law claim two different identities for her. The mother-in-law says, "This man married my daughter. My daughter became ill. She died. Her husband went mad. So he married this woman who nursed him. She's playing the role of the daughter to fulfill his fantasy." And the husband, of course, claims that the mother-in-law thinks that her daughter died, when in fact she was just very ill and she got better. So therefore this woman has to play the role of a stranger to her own mother in order to kind of appease the madness of this other woman. Through the whole play, these characters have just moved to a new town, and so their neighbors and their boss are just trying to figure out what's going on. There's no way of knowing, because each one is more convincing than the last, until finally they bring on the mysterious woman. And she's draped in a black veil, and she explains that she is no one. She is both the daughter and the second wife, and she is neither. And it's really that there is no reality except what exists in the minds of these two people whose lives she is a part of, which is a very fun play and kind of a very simple, I think, comparable type of metaphor as to what we've seen in Copenhagen, of applying that type of relativity to a human scale. Witkiewicz is a very, very strange Polish man who is one of my favorite playwrights now that I've discovered him. And he was very, very interested in science, in non-Euclidean geometries, in relativity, in time, in space. He wanted to create a theater of pure form. He wanted to eliminate psychological causality from theater and kind of create cubism on the stage in a certain sense where it just was. So his play, The Crazy Locomotive, is in many, many senses a joke both for and on Einstein. The basic premise is that an engineer and a fireman get on the train and they start sending it speeding along the tracks out of control and it collides with another train. So we have, of course, on the first level, the question of the train going, the people standing on the station, another train passing, or in this case, colliding, the basic things we think of when we think of Einstein explaining relativity. And then Vitkevitch starts to have fun. The engineer says, "We're not only rushing through space, we're intensely aware of it. There's simply no such thing as relativity of motion for the locomotive engineer. He knows the landscape isn't moving because it's not the landscape he stokes up and oils, but his own locomotive." And of course the joke is that the locomotive is standing still, and behind on the screen is projected scenery that is whizzing by at increasing rates. There's also, he's playing with time dilation and space contraction in this one locomotive engine. From the speeds they describe the locomotive moving and the time, basically time-space of where the two locomotives were, it's very clear that, you know, they had a couple minutes before they were going to crash. And yet, this is a two-act play, you know, with an epilogue after the collision. So, Vitkevitch is allowing the time inside that locomotive to just expand so that these characters can be having the experience of their lives, which is what they were aiming for in the first place. And also, with the space contraction, it's not so much a literalization, since that would be a difficult kind of thing to do in a theatrical space, but it's more that you get the entirety of humanity appearing in this one little engine. You start with the fireman and the engineer, and then the fiancé of the engineer, of the fireman, rather, shows up, bringing along with her the wife of the engineer. And then as they pass the station, some passengers leap on from the station onto the train, and other passengers who are concerned that they've passed the station start climbing up to the front, and so you get a baroness who's, you know, representing the decadent aristocratic class that is fading at this point. You get a couple of bourgeois members of society. The engineer and fireman reveal themselves to be, in fact, none other than the most famous thieves and criminals in the world. You have servants, you have thugs, you have policemen, all in this one, all of society in this one tiny little engine. And then the final figure I wanted to talk about is kind of more problematic for me, and it's one I'm still kind of working through, and that's Brecht. Brecht, of course, in his Short Organum, wrote that he was interested in writing theater for a scientific age. And the Short Organum itself is placing himself in a line going back to Bacon's Novum Organum, which is, of course, going in turn back to Aristotle's Organon. So he's placing himself in this huge line of scientific thought, which I'm not quite sure he lives up to all the time. But I think what interests me most in looking at Brecht as an artist of the scientific age is in his approach to theater rather than in the plays he wrote. He was very interested in Hegel's dialectic, but the way he used it was really, I think, about creating relativistic frames of reference, because there's never a synthesis for Brecht's different frames. The theater does not, the production does not work on its own, and the audience doesn't work on its own unless there's an engagement between them. Otherwise, they just kind of exist in meaninglessness. Same with the relationship between the actor and the text. They have to keep in mind those two separate frames of references at all time for the performance to happen in any kind of significant, effective way. The problem with that, of course, is that for Brecht, there was an underlying truth, you know, and that often came in the form of his politics. And so the solution I've kind of been working towards in my thinking of that is that Brecht was famous for the amount of revisions he did. He revised and revised and changed his politics and changed the meaning of his plays every time he rewrote them. And so I think, though he wouldn't admit it, Brecht himself was demonstrating a certain kind of relativistic approach in that every time his perspective changed, he had to rewrite that truth because it changed with where he was standing. That's all.
I know we're all getting tired, so I will try to get the train rolling out of the station and out the door to the end of things. But it's a great pleasure to be at a gathering like this. I live for gatherings like this, and this has been a very different one from any one I've been to. And I think I've never been to one where the affect started out with a certain kind of dis-ease and has evolved over the days into a different kind of open exchange spirit. And I think part of what Sean mentioned, the International Society for the Study of Time, I think after watching and hearing about the theater science exchange at MIT, for instance, I think what happens in our society that's very different is people come together around a common theme to begin with, and there are clear lines of exchange and dialogue from the beginning. So it's almost the inverse. We start as a given that we're all there to hear from each other about one common thing, and we don't have to find and struggle around for the questions that build bridges and things. So this is an open invitation to you all to join. And I mean that very seriously. We don't have enough dialogue with especially physicists. The society started in 66 largely around physicists and philosophers and has swung toward the humanities a lot, and I think it needs to go back. And my final pitch remark, with due apologies, is that on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, if any of you are still on this coast at Loyola Marymount, we will have a one-day mini-conference with learned members of the society in an interdisciplinary setting, and I have flyers up here about that. Having said that, my approach to intertextual Einstein is much different than it would be conventionally as a lit professor. As a lit professor, it would be, in what ways did Einstein's thinking or the image of Einstein play out in literature? And I actually talked about that yesterday with one example from Faulkner's writing, where he says that an interval of space stretched out before us and space became time. And I convinced at least Professor Plotninsky that it was impossible for him to have written it without some popular reception of Einstein's thinking. But in the few minutes I have, I would like to actually sort of perform or create an intertextual analysis. And in that sense, I think I might be trying to follow the spirit of what Ellen Brody talked about as the change in theater from representing science to enacting it in some way. But I'm not doing anything dramatic like that. I just want to return to one of the most famous paradigmatic images of Einstein that has played intertextually over the years, which is his paradox of riding a light beam or speeding up toward the speed of light and looking at a light beam. And it is one of the great images of him as a character, if you want to put it that way. And I'd like to just take a little time to actually think about that very strange scenario kind of carefully. And I'm trying to do this as a literary trained interpreter, but to take the to try to take the physics seriously enough. And then at the end I will create an intertextual reading, because thinking about that Einstein scenario carefully has led me to actually look at literature through a different lens. And to me, that's always the productivity of interdisciplinary work. You think through another discipline and you take it on and you immerse yourself as much as you can, and then when you go back to yours, you it's an import-export business. So, thought experiments I brought up just briefly in a question the first day. But I think they're amazing because, you know, in certain famous cases, they are brought to bear on a recalcitrant problem, and they yield literally a new point of view from which new concepts or thoughts emerge. So my favorite quote about thought experiments comes from the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze, who said, "If one sees something that traverses life but that resists thought, then one must force thought to think it, make it the hallucination point of thought, an experiment that does violence to thought. The empiricists were not theoreticians but experimenters." And I think this passage actually is helpful in understanding the different inclinations of the early Einstein. That is both the early impact of Mach, so the empiricists were not theoreticians but experimenters, but his concurrent if conflicting interest in reading Kant. So the empiricist and the idealist or rationalist sides of him. So according to Einstein's own testimony, as many of you know so well, one particular thought experiment played a prominent role in his eventual formulation of the special theory in 1905. And in the retrospective autobiographical notes he wrote for the 1949 collection Albert Einstein, Philosopher Scientist, Einstein describes the impasse he faced in the years immediately leading up to the 1905 paper. Quote, "By and by, I despaired of the possibility of discovering the true laws by means of constructive efforts based on known facts," unquote. Only a thought experiment availed Einstein of a transcendental point of view from which to discover the true laws of electrodynamics. He recounts how the seed of the special theory lay dormant in a paradox upon which I had already hit at the age of 16. This paradox was a seemingly simple thought experiment. Imagine, Einstein says, that I pursue a beam of light with the velocity c, the velocity of light in a vacuum. The paradox inflicts a violence on thought, because though according to common sense and classical mechanics, an observer traveling at the speed of light looking at a light beam should see light in a stationary state. Quote, "I should observe such a beam as a spatially oscillatory electromagnetic field at rest," unquote. I should also say that my love of physics came from the language. In slightly more technical terms, the question was this: if a beam of light is an electromagnetic wave, then what would the observable values of the electric and magnetic field vectors be for an observer traveling at light speed? Would these values change locally from zero to full strength and back to zero as one moved along one whole wavelength, as would the case be if a light beam were observed as a spatially oscillatory electromagnetic field at rest? Or would the observations remain consistent with those calculated by Maxwell's equations for such fields? Einstein's answer was simply that, quote, "there seems to be no such thing as a spatially oscillatory electromagnetic field at rest, whether on the basis of experience or according to Maxwell's equations. Therefore," he concludes, "from the very beginning it appeared to me intuitively clear that judged from the standpoint of such an observer, everything would have to happen according to the same laws as for an observer who, from the Earth, who relative to the Earth was at rest." So the common sense reasoning that mechanics-based interpretation would render is that an observer going the same speed as the thing observed will see it at rest, as is well known to freeway flirts exchanging phone numbers while traveling at 70 miles an hour. The paradox of the thought experiment lies in the fact that what one sees is predicted differently according to the laws of mechanics versus Maxwell's electromagnetic field of theory of light. In resolving this paradox, this apparent contradiction between two different fields of physics, Einstein saw his way to the basis of a great synthesis. What I've always found intriguing about Einstein's thought experiment is the way in which it is utterly abstract and strangely concrete at the very same time. That is, it is both a conceptually driven, cognitively created scene and a concrete experimental event that registers a particular perception in a hypothetical observer. To ask what one would see if one traveled at speed c and observed a beam of light is, for a physicist whose views are shaped by Maxwell's work, to probe the nature of the laws of optics as well as the laws of electromagnetic phenomena. Yet this empirical question involving perception does not seem to be asked with an actual physical human being in mind. The whole scene rather unfolds on an entirely conceptual plane shaped by knowledge of the abstract laws of physics. The thought experiment is viewed in an abstract domain whose parameters and rules are inherited from existing physical law. In essence, this thought experiment leads to an observation that falsifies an aspect of a particular theory. In retrospect, it seems as if Einstein first imagines an observation being made, then takes the percept as data, which punctures a hole in a conceptual plane of physics, as it were. To resolve the paradox, one must reconfigure the conceptual plane accordingly. Thus, in some sense, you could say Einstein arrived at a theory by means of a conceptual image, an imaginatively constructed scenario. Reverting to Deleuze's quote, we could say that the thought experiment created the hallucination point of thought from which it became possible to think and invent on the conceptual plane. And here a little parenthetical, given the Kantian dimension of Einstein's inventive thought, it is impossible to resist the temptation to insert here Carl Salick's recollection that while a student in Erra, where he first hit on the paradox, Einstein, instead of attending beer parties, became intoxicated on Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. Given the significant role played by what the hypothetical observer sees in the thought experiment, this viewpoint from which the scenario is seen merits further examination. And here I follow Brian Rotman's Charles Percian analysis of thought experiments. In this model, you can break thought experiments into three components: a person, a subject, and an agent. The person refers to the historical embodied individual. In thinking in terms of a specific discourse, such as theoretical physics, the person becomes a subject of physics or a physicist. And in the thought experiment, the physicist projects an agent who is a proxy for the subject in the imagined scenario of the thought experiment. For our purposes, then, we would distinguish between Einstein, the historical person, Einstein, the physicist enacting the thought experiment, and that agent, the hypothetical observer posited in the thought experiment, who looked at a beam of light traveling at sea. It's one thing to think of Einstein performing this thought experiment at 16. As Sidney Perkowitz pointed out that first day when I brought up thought experiments, he already had a lot of physics. He wasn't just having a kind of adolescent fantasy in thinking of that. But then the Einstein who interprets the thought experiment later, perhaps in 1905, does so as a fully formed subject of physics or physicist. And what the agent traveling at sea observes is construed in the light of all the competing physical theories that he was familiar with by then. But in both cases, the abstract nature of the agent observer stands out clearly. As Rotman has cogently argued, the agent is a severely truncated version of the subject, a disembodied or wholly mechanical and formal proxy for the subject. Simultaneously, though, the trick with thought experiments is that the agent has to sufficiently resemble the subject enough to be conceivable. Or putting the same problem more generally, a thought experiment has to be feasible. While it may not ever actually occur, it must be in principle possible for it to be conducted. So, in the terms of the conference, it has to become a good narrative. In this regard, one of the most striking aspects of Einstein's references to or telling of his thought experiment is the brevity of these accounts. No description of the particulars of the scene is ever given. There is simply an observer at sea traveling looking at a beam of light. Compared to other thought experiments in relativity theory, which are substantiated by all kinds of narrative particulars, lightning bolts, trains, barns, poles, etc., Einstein's account of the light beam scenario amounts to a haiku. In effect, this observer is entirely disembodied. It is a retroactive construction of physical law and the understanding of phenomena they imply. This observer is a science fiction, a fictional agent who exists only on a plane of theoretical physics. But from a popular viewpoint, this agent is part of the authority that Einstein has come to wield as a figure of pure thought. The proxy agent of fiction of science comes to be identified with Einstein, the physicist subject, and at this moment the agent becomes the viewpoint from which a new physics was written. The agent, in a sense, spurred the physicist to a different level of vision. When Einstein says that from the beginning it appeared to me intuitively clear what the observer in his thought experiment would see, appearance and intuition merge as the perceptual act of observation bleeds into the conceptual act of theoretical thinking. The agent's disembodied observing eye pierces through appearances and envisions the scene on a transcendental conceptual plane. So, having thought about this thought experiment in this way, I one day realized that one of the foundational moments of American literature seems to me exactly the same kind of disembodied agent projecting a viewpoint from which a whole new way of thinking comes. And that is Ralph Waldo Emerson's passage in Nature in 1836, where he imagines himself becoming a transparent eyeball. And I'm not going to do a detailed analysis, I'm simply going to read the passage and leave the comparison at that, because I know my 10 minutes are done. So, but essentially, this is one of the foundational moments of American literature, the birth of transcendentalism, Emerson ceasing to be a divinity school product and becoming a writer, and it's an image that is over and over replayed. There's an intertextual life that this image has had. So this is the Emerson passage. Standing on the bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am part or parcel of God. So the shifty I that Emerson constructs here, and pronouns are of course shifters, doubles as both a participant in a scene, I eyeball, and an analyst of it, I see all. So it's both the agent and the subject. He's both epistemologically detached and ontologically participating, the same kind of split in which Einstein's agent-observer and Einstein the physicist accomplishes with the thought experiment. And in both cases, a transcendental point of view enables an entire discourse and vision of the world to emerge.
Thanks to everybody. It all makes me wonder how science and the image of science would be different if, you know, Enrico Fermi had been the iconic figure of 20th century physics, or Murray Gell-Mann. So we have time for maybe one or two questions. So let's start in the back.
I was very intrigued by Ralph's mention that the problem with Einstein and presenting him as a dramatic figure is the lack of an antagonist. And it immediately brought to my mind that the antagonist is the quantum world, because even though Einstein had a great early triumph in his thoughts in quantum mechanics, winning, of course, the Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect, he was really the last great classical physicist. General relativity, special relativity are all rooted in classical physics, continuum mathematics. And he, in my mind, was like Moses coming up to the promised land. And though he wasn't forbidden, he actually chose not to enter. And so in a sense, that was the antagonist, was he was always fighting that quantum world, and in the end became a very tragic figure in becoming so isolated. I don't know if that could, in some sense, create a dramatic dramatic line that might have some possibilities.
I know there's at least one answer to
this question. It's not an answer, but that's a point I wanted to make as well. So I've been, you know, this is the year of Einstein, and I'm giving about, going around the world, five or six lectures on, and what I talk about is half of Einstein's life, the tragic half, the half that's never written about, by the way, neither by historians or popularizers or playwrights or anybody, the half which is tragic, the half which has contained many failures, many mistakes, a totally different side, tragic side of Einstein, where he was still this cuddly, lovely figure, celebrity, political actor, but on the scientific side, he was regarded with some contempt by his contemporaries, and he himself knew that he wasn't succeeding, rather tragic, in fact. A left out part in this mythical Einstein or the popular Einstein, and certainly, you know, if I was thinking as you asked that question, just as you were, you know, what the play would be. Well, you have two acts, the triumphant Einstein, the tragic failure, and then the third act, I don't know how you resolve it. But the second act, remarkably, kind of like the Denison, you know, all of you guys write about the same episodes. the same 10 years, 15 years. There are 30 years after that.
I think we'll just give the panel a chance to respond, and then we're out of time.
Yeah, just a quick response about the antagonist. In fact, I derived that idea, which I don't entirely subscribe to, from Brecht's notes about his Einstein play. And of course, Brecht would conceive an antagonist quite different than we might. Certainly, we could write a play in which, in fact, quantum physics and the whole kind of the complication that Einstein was trying to forestall would become the antagonist. And in fact, that is a tragic, I think, occurrence, which the insignificance play takes up a little bit, because here we see him kind of as a lonely figure in this hotel room working on a unified field theory and so forth. And it's very clear that he's kind of doomed in that way, that he has only a few years to live. But Brecht, of course, would have wanted a socially definable antagonist in some particular way, in which he could, in fact, give to Galileo very easily, because history supplied it. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why Brecht sort of retreats to Galileo rather than do the Einstein play. But I
think that in Act 3, Einstein returns from the dead and tells you which compactification of string theory is the right one. 10 to the 500 that you have to deal with.
Yeah, but it seems to me that Einstein's life is full of antagonists. I mean, starting with his mother when he was a young man and couldn't get married, to various physicists he had fights with along the way. There were the anti-relativist movement in Berlin in 1920, 1921, leading to him eventually being driven out of Germany in 1933. There's the McCarthy period in America. There's no end of antagonists to Einstein. Pardon me?
They're no Einstein. Kate, would you want to have any last words?
Gives me great pause to go back to the second half of its life, but I'll answer on Dennis's behalf. How many hundreds of pages did it take to write those years? You're asking a great deal of him to keep going.
Okay, let's thank everyone again and then go get coffee.